Hello, everybody. Sorry we're getting started a little late, a little technical problem, but here we are. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. So as I'm sure you've heard, Jill Stein announced that she's stepping up to run for the Green Party presidential nomination. And I think we all should thank her. It's a lot of work, and she's really rescuing us after everybody was counting on Cornel West to do it, who then stepped away and dropped us. So I think the first thing I want to note is that Jill's campaign is fundamentally different from Cornel West's campaign, because she's running with the Green Party to build the Green Party as a political alternative that will be sustained over time in this country, whereas Cornel West is now just running a one-off campaign for himself. That's fundamental. So I think, if for no other reason, they're very close on policy, but we should support Jill. And of course, I have my political differences with both of them. I'm more socialist on social and economic and environmental policy, and more consistently anti-imperialist on foreign policy, because I oppose imperialism by anti-US states like Russia, China, and Iran, as much as I oppose imperialism by the US and its allies, including Israel. But compared to Biden, who many progressives are saying they're going to support just to stop Trump, I think there's no doubt that we should support the Stein campaign. If we don't vote for what we want, for things like the Green New Deal and Medicare for all, and a foreign policy that prioritizes diplomacy and international law before military intervention, we'll never get them. A vote for Biden is a vote for what we don't want: more fossil fuels, unbridled militarism. He's opposed to Medicare for all. He wants to keep privatized health insurance. In fact, he's privatizing Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration. A vote for Biden is a vote for what we don't want. A vote for Stein is a vote for many of the things we do want. And if we don't vote for what we want, we silence ourselves. Your vote is your voice in elections, so you should use it to support what you want. And now I'll just say, and we can talk a lot more about, you know, her campaign and how this fits into everything, but early money in these campaigns makes a big difference, especially for the ballot access drives that can begin now in most states where the Greens are not yet on the ballot. So her campaign needs money right away. And let's put her website on there where you can contribute. Let's put it in the chat. And I urge everybody to, you know, dig down and give her some money so we can get this campaign rolling, because it's getting started late. And like I said, you know, I think we all should be thankful that she's stepping up in difficult circumstances. I mean, I don't think she planned to do this. But she is kind of rescuing us. So, you know, give her some support. Another thing I want to just note, while we're all focused on what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank, and, you know, which is just a crime against humanity, is that there's another crime against humanity going on, and that's the climate emergency, which is not being paid attention to. There's a new study out this week that shows that oil and gas producing countries are increasing oil and gas production as the planet accelerates into a climate breakdown. The study finds the US plans to produce more oil and gas in 2030 than it ever has. I mean, Biden's climate program is really pathetic when you think about it. It relies on market incentives for the same giant energy and auto and manufacturing corporations that built and still profit from fossil fuel production that we have to completely replace. We need an eco-socialist Green New Deal with public ownership for much of the energy, transportation, and manufacturing sectors, so we can plan and execute a rapid transition to 100% clean energy and zero and then negative greenhouse gas emissions. And what we're doing now is we're going in the wrong direction. So we have US energy giants planning to produce more oil and gas in 2030 than ever before, but so do most of the major oil and gas countries and companies like Russia and Saudi Arabia. In fact, most of the top 20 oil and gas producing countries, including Brazil and Canada, plan on increasing production over the rest of this decade. India plans to double its coal production by 2030. I mean, that's insane. There are a few countries that have reduced and plan to reduce their oil and gas and coal production over the next 7 years. And that includes Colombia, China, Germany, Norway, and the United Kingdom. But that's not going to do it. The U.S. really needs to step up. And if the oil and gas production increases the way it's planned by these countries and giant corporations from now until 2030, we are guaranteed to surpass the 2 degrees centigrade or Celsius rise in temperatures, which was what the climate conference in Paris in 2015 set as a goal and pledged that countries would do things to avoid. And it's obvious they're not. And every week we get more studies showing that the climate catastrophe is unfolding at a faster pace as these countries and corporations continue business as usual. Just to point out a couple, Arctic temperatures studies are showing are rising at twice the pace that they did before the year 2000. And correspondingly, Greenland's glaciers are now melting at twice the rate they did before the year 2000. Not to mention all the tundra melting, releasing carbon dioxide and methane, which is much more potent as a greenhouse gas. And then Antarctic temperatures are growing even faster, three times as fast as the world average. And its glaciers are now melting at three times the rate they did in 2007. And of course, that means lots of sea rise and is an indication of all the things, how much the planet is heating up. And so the next COP conference, Conference of the Parties, the UN Climate Conference that's annual, is being hosted by a major oil and gas producing country, the United Arab Emirates. That's in early December. And the UAE official leading the summit is Sultan Ahmed Al Jaber, who is head of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, the state-owned oil company that provides 3% of the world's oil annually. What could go wrong? Protests by youthful climate activists have been fixtures at previous UN climates, but protests are banned in the United Emirates. So I don't think we can look forward or anticipate much coming out of the UN Climate Summit this year, for sure, and it really hasn't measured up in the past. And that's why it's so important to have Green Party candidates pushing this eco-socialist Green New Deal in next year's elections and in climate mobilizations in the streets. I mean, I was at the climate march there in New York City, and they were making demands on Biden, but they really weren't calling for the kind of eco-socialist Green New Deal that we need. And, it's going to take, real radical change in this country so we can lead in this global eco-socialist Green New Deal we need. Because in addition to reducing our own emissions to zero and then negative, just to fulfill our climate responsibility given historic emissions, we have to help other countries. There was a study a few years ago that said, Biden wants to reduce emissions by 50% by 2030. He's not going to come close. This study said that the U.S. needs to reduce emissions by 70% by 2030 in the U.S. and 195% overall. And how can we do that? I mean, how do you do 195%? By helping other countries make the transition to clean energy. So that's the global Green New Deal. Call it climate reparations, paying for loss and damage caused by historic emissions and current emissions by the U.S., whatever you call it, that's what the U.S. should do and can do to really address this climate change. As it is now, the U.S. and the major world powers are doubling down on fossil fuels instead of a clean energy transition. And this is a life or death issue. The climate refugees, parts of the world are becoming uninhabitable because of the temperatures And that exacerbates all kinds of other problems. So we really need to step up our work on this. And, you know, that's one reason I'm glad Jill is running, because, you know, the Green New Deal was a thing that she ran as a theme on in 2012 and 2016. And it did get into the debate. You know, the Democratic, progressive Democrats did pick it up. They watered it down, but it's part of the debate now. And, you know, that's because Greens ran. We didn't just, you know, fold for, you know, our positions to back the Democrats because they're not as bad as the Republicans. So that's why it's important that we present our own programs. And we need to really, you know, this is not just bearing witness. This is really, we want power. We want to win elections. We want to change things. And we got to think about it that way. And I think, you know, what we do at the local level, we have over 150 local elected officials, which can be multiplied many times. And that creates a foundation for running for state legislature and the House of Representatives. That's what we should be doing. And we can do it. So I hope people are mad as hell and inspired to do this. And I guess the last thing I'll comment on is, you know, there was a huge demonstration today in Britain. Today's Veterans Day, and Congress originally named this holiday Armistice Day in 1926 to mark the anniversary of the end of World War I, and for the purpose of holding ceremonies promoting peace among nations. But in 1954, Congress changed the holiday to Veterans Day. And that was part of promoting U.S. militarism. And, you know, you get a sense from the kind of Veterans Day activities we have today. And U.S. militarism was exploding in 1954. That's what came out of World War II when the U.S. became the world's most powerful imperialist superpower. And so they changed it to try to mobilize public support behind that. And we're still dealing with that today. We should return Veterans Day to Armistice Day, back to its original purpose. And today in Britain, people were doing it. They call it Armistice Day there. They also have a Remembrance Day on the Sunday around it, which is for the veterans. But it's not as stark in the turn to militarism from pushing for peace that the, you know, elimination of Armistice Day was in this country. So they expected 500,000. I've seen police reports say 300,000 marched. I looked at the aerial photographs that have been shown on online and some of the news reports. I'll tell you, there was a lot more people today in London than we had in Washington, D.C. last week. I mean, that was a good demonstration, but people I've talked to, you know, who've been at huge demonstrations in Washington going back to the 60s say there's no way there was 300,000 there on last Saturday. It was more like 50 to 100,000. But it still was significant. I mean, that's the biggest anti-war demonstration we've had since Iraq. I think it is having an impact on the Biden administration. You know, we're getting reporting now that Biden's been urging Netanyahu, Israel, to take a humanitarian pause, as they call it, of 3 days or more, not 4 hours now and then like Israel's doing. And Blinken said bluntly yesterday that Israel is killing, quote, far too many Palestinians. So, you know, they're hearing, you know, our demonstrations. They're looking at the polls, which show Biden is radically losing support among young progressives and in the Arab and Muslim communities, which, if that holds, is going to doom his presidential campaign. They're going to have to fundamentally reverse policy to win those people back. Arab leaders and analysts were warning Blinken publicly yesterday that the U.S. support for Israel's genocidal war in Gaza is creating hostility toward the U.S. in the Arab worlds and throughout the post-colonial global South that could last for generations. And I think the Biden administration and the U.S. foreign policy elite are beginning to get that message. I mean, I've heard people like Richard Haass, who's a recently retired head of the Foreign Policy Association, puts out, or Foreign Affairs, whatever it's called, they put out Foreign Affairs magazine. He's been speaking about this. I think, you know, he is an indicator of what they're worried about. So I think we need to keep pressing, not only for a ceasefire, but an end to U.S. military aid to Israel until it ends its policies of occupation and apartheid. That's what the BDS movement, that's been so demonized by the political establishment, calling it anti-Semitic. I mean, you look at the National BDS, the National Palestinian BDS Committee, and you know what they say. They say this is a nonviolent way of resisting the Israeli occupation and apartheid. And they explicitly say, we oppose anti-Semitism. Nobody associated with this movement should be doing anti or saying anti-Semitic things. And that's where we got to go, because we got to pressure Israel, not just jawboning like Biden is apparently doing behind the scenes, but much more strongly. We've been giving them a blank check since the Oslo process back in the early 90s. And they've been expanding the settlements in the West Bank with impunity. And the U.S. keeps giving them $3.8 billion a year in military aid. Now they want to give them $14.3 or $6 billion more to prosecute this war in Gaza. I mean, if that continues to be U.S. policy, we are going to be isolated. And even when the U.S. is doing what it should be doing in supporting Iran or Ukraine's just war of self-defense, we look like hypocrites. The U.S. looks like hypocrites because it's supporting Israeli occupation while it's opposing Russian occupation. But why should anybody take us seriously when we're seen as supporting Israeli colonialism? And you can go around the world, you know, the Moroccans and Spanish Sahara with U.S. support, the Indonesians in East Papua with U.S. support, the Indians in Kashmir with U.S. support. People in the global South pay much more attention to international affairs and what the U.S. does than most Americans do. And they see the hypocrisy. And, you know, if the U.S. is going to play a constructive role in the world, we can't be hypocrites. So this war in Israel, I think, you know, it's time to not just demand a ceasefire, but start emphasizing cut off military aid to Israel until it ends its policies of occupation and apartheid. So to help counter that hypocritical position, I tweeted a thread of 10 statements supporting both Ukrainian and Palestinian liberation, most of them by Ukrainians and Palestinians, including two Palestinian Ukrainians. One lived in Palestine and was pushed out by Israeli aggression. He moved to Ukraine, started a family there, and 20 years later, he got pushed out by Russian aggression. So he's seen it from both sides. And the other is by a woman whose mother is Ukrainian and father is Palestinian. And actually, her mother's a doctor, and she's stuck in Gaza right now. They're powerful statements, so I urge you to go through it. I mean, it'll take you a while to get through all 10 statements, and the one by the woman whose parents are Ukrainian-Palestinian is a video statement. So we'll get that in the chat. And when I was talking about climate change and how all these countries are increasing their oil and gas production through 2030, I was referring to a study which we'll put in the chat too. It's called The Production Gap. So I'm through for now. So that's like 26 minutes. Where I started late. So I guess we'll go a couple minutes later. So I'm looking forward to your comments and questions. Justice Fee, happy Armistice Day, Howie and all. Yes, indeed. Isn't Jill still in debt from her last run? Yes, she has a fine from the FEC of $175,000, which is due in December. So, yep, that's why I'm all the more grateful that she stepped up, because she has that hanging over her head. But she's, I really respect her commitment to the Green Party and, you know, stepping up where we really didn't have a candidate. I mean, I look at the other candidates, none of them has the capacity to run a serious campaign for a small town council or school board seat. So, you know, I think we need to be grateful and supporter. So, yeah, that's going to be a burden for Jill. I see Scout Trooper says Happy Vets Day. We're saying Happy Armistice Day, Scout Trooper, because that's what I talked about at the beginning. The U.S. changed it from Armistice Day to Veterans Day, kind of to promote militarism, instead of what Armistice Day was originally supposed to promote, which is peace among nations. And I suggest we get back to that. I see Steve Welser's greener, right there it is. A composite picture of Jill Cornell and RFK on the cover with the headline, 2024 will be a chance to break the grip of the duopoly. Yeah, I think Jill is head and shoulders above Cornell just based on how he can't run a campaign. It doesn't seem serious or competent. And RFK, who's, you know, really gone off the rails on vaccines and various conspiracy theories and blind support for Israel's aggression, and I could go on. So I get it. I think people, it'll catch people's eye, although I hate to see Jill sort of put in the same, you know, bag with Cornel West and RFK. But anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to that issue. Scout Trooper 164, there's mention that $300 billion in Russian assets may be unfrozen to help Ukraine. Any thoughts on that? I personally hope so, especially with the end of being involved with Israel's war. Hopefully with the end of being involved with Israel's war. I think, I'm not sure what that last clause means, but yeah, there's been talk all along that these assets of Russian oligarchs, which are basically, they've taken money out of Russia, much of it ill-gotten, and put it into American banks and real estate assets as a way of laundering that money so it comes out the other end clean. And so people have suggested, let's give that money to Ukraine. They are in a debt trap like much of the global South. And one of the demands that the left in Ukraine has been asking us to support is debt cancellation, so they can use their resources to defend themselves now and rebuild the country after the war. And that's what this $300 billion could be used for. And, you know, there's talk of Russia owing reparations for the damage they've caused to Ukraine. Well, there's a down payment, that $300 billion. So I think that's a good idea. There are legal technicalities involved that I'm not totally up on. I understand that. But, you know, smart lawyers can find ways around things. So I think that is definitely something that should be pursued. And I guess what you're saying at the end is that we should be supporting Ukraine instead of Israel's aggression against the Palestinians, which I agree with. John Wood, in an age where independent media is rising and legacy media's influence is waning, can third parties and independent candidates host a debate on a par to those betwixt Democratic and Republican nominees? I still think the mass media coverage of presidential debates by the major networks and cable TV is going to, you know, have a much, much larger audience than any kind of independent media sponsored debate. So I think that's just where we still are at. But I don't know what's going to happen with debates this time. You know, Trump is, and the Republican Party said they're no longer going to participate in this Commission on Presidential Debates, which was really a joint operation of the Democratic and Republican parties to keep out everybody else. Now, you know, Trump and the Republicans aren't even participating in that. And then there's talk that, you know, Biden saying, well, if Trump is convicted of a felony, why should he, you know, give him a stage? He's not worthy of being on a presidential debate stage. So I don't even know if there's going to be a major party presidential debate this cycle. Having said that, you know, if independent media can put together a good debate, there is one proposed by a group called Free and Equal, which is kind of a libertarian operation. I went to a couple of their debates in 2020. They've had them before. They're really marginal compared to, you know, what you get in the major mass media or what, you know, more prominent independent media could put on. You know, if Democracy Now! And the Real News Network and groups like that pulled together a debate, I think it would have a much larger audience. So I don't think independent media has realized its potential. And it's something that, given that the major parties may not debate, could you know, be significant if they do pull it together for 2024. So, you know, we should encourage them to do that. Scout Trooper 164, Elon Musk keeps demanding Ukraine to surrender while Russians didn't ask to be there. Yeah, because Russia sure didn't start invading the country. That's sarcastic. I get it. I think you're right. Elon Musk, he's a right winger. You know, I think it's, people have to realize the most support that Russia is getting for their invasion and the most opposition to Ukraine getting the arms it needs to defend itself is coming from the right wing in this country. Elon Musk, Margaret Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, you know, all these far right MAGA Republicans in the House, Tucker Carlson, you know, people like that. And, you know, they are, you know, the reason is they love Russia. They love Russia because it's anti-gay, it's anti-trans, it's anti-feminism. There's pending legislation to make anybody advocating feminism, they call it an extremist ideology. The economic inequality in Russia is as bad as it is in the U.S. and getting worse. But that's what the right wing likes. Plus, they like the authoritarian one man rule. They don't really believe in democracy. So I think those are things we need to keep in mind. And, you know, just in terms of arms to Ukraine, I think one thing people need to think about, if you're thinking we should oppose that, is what about air defense systems? You know, that's the only reason the Russian Air Force can't bomb the hell out of Ukraine like they did out of Aleppo in Syria or Grozny in Chechnya they did before. Instead, they have to use artillery and missiles and drones, which most of which are the air defenses can stop, but not all of them. And, you know, the plan now for Russia, they're increasing their military budget 70% next year. They're planning for 3 more years of war. And so, you know, if Ukraine doesn't have at least air defenses, you know, Russia's going after their power system. So people are denied heat and electricity this coming winter. Do we want to deny them? I don't see how you can stop, you know, bombing from the air with nonviolent resistance. I mean, there's a time when you have to defend yourself. And so I just hope people keep that in mind. I mean, Ukraine at least needs to have the air defenses to stop them from being turned into, you know, their cities being turned into what Mariupol became. And I think another thing to keep in mind is the contrast between how Ukraine took back the city of Kherson. They didn't bomb Kherson. They basically cut the supply lines to the Russian army in the part of Kherson Oblast or province to the north and west of the Dnieper River, and Russia had to retreat. So they got Kherson back. But once the Ukrainians got it back, Russia started lobbing artillery daily into Kherson, the city, killing a lot of people who were, you know, hitting residential buildings And now the city's largely depopulated because the Russians are just bombing it. It's not a military target. They're bombing civilians. It's terrorism. So that is a mess. And, you know, I hope people who are consistent in opposing Russia's invasion and occupation of Ukraine, like we're opposing Israel's invasion and occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. Frankie Lee. Yeah, I asked if Jill has a running mate choice. What about Margaret Kimberly? She's more diplomatic than Ajamu Baraka. I would say she's probably more diplomatic than Ajamu, although they pretty much agree. I have a problem with their politics when it comes to international politics. They are, you know, supportive or at least apologetic for, you know, very authoritarian police states like Syria, Russia, because they're anti-US. And I think we need to stand against all imperialisms and all authoritarianism and with the people who are fighting to liberate themselves from that. So that takes a class analysis of who's oppressed and who's oppressing, rather than this geopolitical analysis, which removes the working classes and the popular classes from any agency in these struggles and just pick sides between capitalist countries. And that to me is not what we should be doing on the left. So that's the policy issue I have with Jill as well. But you know, if you do a balance sheet on, you know, where she stands compared to where Biden stands, I mean, she wins on almost every issue, as far as I'm concerned, except some of these foreign policy issues. So I think it's something I will keep, you know, talking about and raising, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to support the Green candidate. John Wood, do you think we can recruit Chris Hedges, Richard Wolf, or Ralph Nader as Jill's VP? Well, Jill's going to have to recruit him. I think she could do better. I think ideally she would get a young Latina woman or Black woman who speaks for those movements, you know, is credible in those movements. Immigration is a huge issue for Latinos, and they're alienated from Biden. I think there's a lot of potential there. I know Ralph is going to want to stay independent. He's going to want to try to influence Biden as well as, you know, give props to the Greens, like he did in 2020. So I think, you know, my advice to Jill would be to look for a younger person of color who comes out of the movements, has credibility there. That would probably be the best VP candidate to balance the ticket. Vicky Corden, November 17 is the deadline for government shutdown again. They talk about cutting aid to Ukraine. Your thoughts? Yeah, the Republicans, this guy Johnson from Louisiana, he says he wants to support Ukraine, but he didn't want to send them any aid, which, you know, that's just bullshit. And yeah, they're going to make Ukraine part of the equation. What they're really going after, these MAGA Republicans, is more restrictions on domestic spending. I mean, the debt deal we got before is it prevents any increased spending on domestic issues for a certain period. I forget, maybe 2 years. They're going to want more of that. They're saying openly they want to cut Social Security and Medicare to deal with the deficit, even though those are independently funded and are solvent, particularly Social Security, if we lift the tax cap. Where people make an income, now it's about $160,000. Any money you make over that, you don't have to pay the Social Security tax on it. If we just lifted that cap, you know, Social Security would be solvent as far as we can see into the future. And then, of course, Medicare. The problem for Medicare is the private health insurance, the private side of healthcare is driving costs up and up and up. So what we really need is Medicare for all, much more efficient system that would cover everybody at less cost than our mixed private and public system now. So that's what should be being talked about in Congress. But, you know, the Democrats, what they tend to do is instead of, fighting the Republicans, they want to accommodate them in quote unquote bipartisan agreements, which, you know, given that these MAGA Republicans are, you know, they don't compromise. It's the Democrats that do all the compromising. If the government shuts down, I mean, the one thing the Democrats will be able to do is blame the Republicans if they're smart on their messaging. And maybe the Republicans see that and they will come to some kind of deal. But, you know, it's a problem. And the House in Congress is so dysfunctional, it's hard to believe. And people around the world see that. I mean, I follow a lot of what people in Ukraine and now in Israel and Palestine are saying. And I mean, they're just astounded at how incompetent and amateurish. I mean, we look like a banana republic, you know. There's no respect for the U.S. because of these crazy people in the House. So we'll see what happens, but it doesn't look good. Beattie Dimmitt, we still need to fully fund medical school if we are going to commit to providing health care for everyone. We are way short on doctors. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, one of the good things in the healthcare legislation that Bernie Sanders keeps introducing is it does address that. The single payer bills do have some money in there for, funding the education of more doctors. And that's what we need. You're right about that. We're understaffed in terms of doctors and providing the care we need. I know doctors that have 5,000 patients. I mean, how do you keep track and do a good job with that many people? It's crazy. Our doctor per population ratio is way high, much higher than countries with much less wealth like Cuba and Costa Rica. Violet at Content Boutique. I've been hearing that money sent to Ukraine was squandered. Well, the U.S. Has been watching where the money for the weapons goes and where the weapons themselves go, and they found no diversion of its intended target. There is reporting that some of the money going for economic and humanitarian aid is being diverted by corruption. And that's a problem Ukraine and many countries in the former Soviet Union have. It seems to be improving, but yes, yeah, some of that money may have been taken by crooks, and some of them are being prosecuted. It's hard sometimes to uncover these schemes, but they should be uncovered. And I think the Zelensky government is committed to clamping down on corruption. But it's complicated, both politically in terms of the Ukrainian power structure. Oligarchs still play a big role. So it's a difficult problem. But the arms, I mean, the U.S. has a lot of inspection on that. The MAGA Republicans have pushed for that. And the study just came out recently said, you know, they could find no weapons diverted. Scout Trooper 164, Russia, according to the U.S. State Department, is trying to do propaganda in Latin America to make it seem Ukraine is failing. We need to stand up and stop that. You read what the Russians are saying. Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is about to collapse, you know, in a couple of weeks. They've been saying that since they first invaded and got their butt whipped trying to take Kyiv. They say we've come to a stalemate and the counteroffensive failed. But another way of looking at that is Russia failed and Ukraine, with, you know, much smaller country with less military resources, has fought Russia to a stalemate in defending itself. And one thing's clear, there have been polls done by the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology of what Ukrainians think about. The question is, would you be willing to give up land, Ukrainian land to Russia in return for peace, or do you want to keep fighting until you get that land back? And 80% and up have consistently said throughout the war, including the most recent poll out, that they want their land back and they're going to keep fighting for it. So, you know, with that kind of spirit, Ukraine can't be defeated, even if they end up resorting to guerrilla war, because, you know, they don't get the support from the U.S. and the West that they should get. You know, you just need to look at a country like Afghanistan. People will fight for their own country, and the invaders, you know, Afghanistan has pushed out empires for hundreds of years, centuries. And the Russians found that out in the 80s, and the U.S. found that out in the 2000s. So I think, you know, Ukraine isn't failing. They're struggling because Russia's invaded them and bombing them. Steve Walser, a friend of the Ukrainians, would have advised avoidance of involvement with NATO in inevitable disasters unfolding for Ukraine after their misleadership made the mistake of listening to the U.S. Well, I would disagree with that. The U.S., I mean, Bush said, yeah, we want Ukraine in NATO against the advice of most people in the State Department and the Pentagon. And nothing has happened since 2008 in that regard. And most Ukrainians didn't want involvement with NATO. The polls show that until Russia invaded Crimea and Donbass in 2014. And then support for joining NATO to help defend them from Russia grew pretty steadily. And then after the full-scale invasion, February 22nd, 2022, it became overwhelmingly the people of Ukraine want NATO's security protection. So I don't think you can blame Ukraine for pushing into NATO as if that's what provoked the Russians and created the disaster. It was after the Russians invaded that the people of Ukraine really started pushing to get into NATO, because they need the support for their defense. You know, I would rather see the West go to Russia and say, okay, you're worried about your security. Let's negotiate mutually agreeable security arrangements. And let's get back into these nuclear arms control treaties that the U.S. pulled out of under Bush. They pulled out of the anti-ballistic missiles treaty, and then under Trump out of the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty and the open skies treaty. Now Russia's saying they don't want to negotiate the strategic arms reduction treaty because of, you know, they want the U.S. to stop supporting Ukraine. I mean, we're in a really bad situation, but one of the rationales for Russia's invasion was they said they felt their security was threatened. Well, the U.S. should very publicly say, okay, we're ready to negotiate that, particularly the nuclear arms agreements. And the treaty that Russia pulled out of was the conventional arms treaty. And so that needs to be restored. So all these things, you know, need to be negotiated. And, you know, I think that's where the U.S. should really push its diplomatic efforts to hopefully end this war. Because if Putin and the West can agree on those security arrangements, Putin could say, well, okay, we want our objectives going into Ukraine, and withdraw and say he won, or at least he realized his objectives. I think that's the most likely way to end the war, although I'm skeptical, because I think in terms of Russia's domestic politics, war is the health of the state. And Putin wants, you know, perpetual war in order to justify the repression and the concentration of power in his clique of power holders. And I think they're really afraid that, you know, the kind of democratic uprising we saw with the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine, what the Russians call color revolutions. You know, whenever people rise up against their oppressors, Putin says it's a color revolution sponsored by the CIA, as if the people in these countries have no, don't have their own beasts with their own power structures. And he's worried that'll come back into Russia. I mean, there were massive demonstrations after the elections. People said were rigged in 2011, 2012. They had another round of protests in 2019, 2020. With this full-scale invasion, they've just criminalized all public dissent from the Kremlin's line. And I think that's what the war gives Putin. It's a way of, for him to hold on to power and divert people's attention from the misery they're going through with their economic hardships. So despite that, I still think the U.S. should go to Russia and say, let's work out these security agreements so everybody feels secure. I think that's the best shot we got. Scout Trooper 164, didn't Ukraine try to have peace talks over 100 times with Russia, but Russia violated the agreements? I think someone pointed this out online. That was the Minsk II agreements. And the problem with Minsk II, which really France and Germany especially pushed Ukraine to accept, was there was a lot of ambiguities in what they agreed to. For example, Russia was supposed to withdraw its heavy weaponry and its truces and let Ukraine take control of the borders between Russia and Ukraine in the Donbas region. And Russia never did that. Russia was saying, first, you have to pass a constitutional amendment to give more autonomy to the two Donbas oblasts, Luhansk and Donetsk. And Ukraine was saying, well, first, give us our borders. And then there were supposed to be elections internationally supervised in the Donbass. And Russia went ahead and held elections under their own supervision in the areas they controlled. And so Zelensky, I mean, they say he ran as a peace candidate. He did. He said, I'm going to negotiate with Russia using the Minsk platform to get the Russians out of the Donbass and Crimea. I mean, that was right in his platform. People don't actually read his platform, but that's what he said. And the over 100 times, yeah, there were meetings between Ukrainian and Russian officials on implementing Minsk over 100 times between, when was it, January or February 2015, and when the full-scale invasion started. They were talking right up until, you know, the invasion happened. So, yeah, and, you know, the Ukrainians say, you know, we tried talking to them. We can't trust them because they don't live up to their side of the agreements. Of course, Russian propaganda says the Ukrainians broke the agreements. The truth is neither side implemented what they were supposed to. And both sides had the excuse, well, you know, the other side has to take the first step. So it was a problem. And for the Ukrainians, they were kind of forced into that Minsk agreement at a time when they really didn't have a military. When Russia went into Donbass and Crimea, they had 5,000 combat-ready troops, maybe a dozen tanks, and a couple aircraft. That's why these volunteer battalions, Azov is the most famous, but there were many of them, and the right-wingers were a minority, but they were part of it. They formed, you know, militias to fight the Russian invasion. And it was, you know, at that time, Ukraine was in a weak position when they forced the Minsk agreements. And what the Ukrainians really objected to was the autonomy and power that was given to these two oblasts and Donbass basically gave them a veto over Ukrainian foreign policy and national policy. And that was unacceptable to most Ukrainians. I mean, I found that out. We talked with a guy named Pavlo Kazan, who is probably Ukraine's foremost environmental scientist. He helped start the Green Party there. He was head of Friends of the Earth of Ukraine. He's a very famous environmental scientist, you know, internationally recognized. And we had a phone call, you know, a Zoom call with him maybe in December as Russia was amassing its troops on the Ukrainian border. And, you know, we asked him about, you know, the claims of Russia that the Russian speakers are oppressed and being killed. And he said, you know, as a Russian speaking Ukrainian from, you know, Eastern Ukraine, he's from Dnipro. He said it's nonsense. And that the problem with Minsk was it gave Russia control over Ukrainian foreign and national policies. So it was not popular. And this is a guy, you know, on the progressive side of Ukrainian politics. So that was a problem all along. The Minsk framework, you know, it was vague, as I said, because the sequence of steps to be taken wasn't specified. So Ukraine and Russia kept telling the other side to take the first step, and they didn't. Vicky Corden, it seems the Russians are sticking their dirty hands in elections in Latin America. Russians want to conquer everyone, if that is true. Well, the Russians and Americans, you know, I have intelligence operations, and they are trying to influence elections around the world. There was a study came out 2 or 3 years ago by a guy, a professor whose first name is Dov. I can't remember his last name. He did a study of this, I think, since World War II. And, you know, the Americans are the worst. They've done it over 100 times. The Russians are the second worst, you know, about half as often as the U.S. does. And that's, you know, propaganda. It's misinformation. It's sometimes money. The Russians are sticking their dirty hands in elections. Unfortunately, so are the Americans. And it's something that ought to be stopped, you know, on both sides. But, I was going to say, you know, anybody that thinks Russia's not imperialist needs to look at what they're doing in Africa, where, you know, the Wagner group, and now its replacement, which seems to be under the control of the Ministry of Defense in Russia, they are propping up dictatorships, and what they get in return, you know, providing security for those dictatorships, what they get in return are gold, diamond, timber, and oil concessions. And so it's classic, you know, colonialism or neocolonialism. John Wood, Argentina is going to have a runoff election between a Peronist candidate and a far right one. What do you make of this? It's sort of a tragedy that the left, and this is globally, you know, it's just not building credible parties that can win popular support. And so you're left with a choice between a kind of a centrist populist and a far right populist who calls himself a libertarian. And, you know, his policies are just really nutcase policies. So Ukraine, you know, I haven't looked at the election closely, but I've, you know, sort of seen it at the level you've just described it, and it doesn't look good. So I just, you know, that's the problem around the world. The left, the secular left, you know, in the Middle East got crushed with the support of British, U.S. and Israeli imperialism. You know, it's well known that Israel was propping up or encouraging Hamas as an alternative to the Palestine Liberation Organization and Fatah, the major group in it, which was secular and nationalist and, you know, leftist, at least part of the coalition. They wanted this, you know, conservative religious alternative. And of course, be careful what you wish for, because now they got it. And that group, you know, became terrorist and very violent. And, you know, it's chickens coming home to roost. You know, the policies of occupation and expansion of Israel, you know, that they just, the Palestinians aren't going away, and the rest of the Arab world, certainly the Arab street, the public, as opposed to these corrupt right-wing leaders, is definitely behind the Palestinians' struggle. So, you know, it doesn't pay off in the long run to support oppressors, because because the oppressed eventually going to fight back. Vicky Corden, Russia can invade other European countries, especially if aid to Ukraine is cut out. I think that's true. I think, you know, the countries that are most likely on their list are Moldova and Georgia. But certainly the Baltic states are worried about it. Poland's worried about it for historical reasons. And, you know, the ruling elites in Russia are, they're Russian, great Russian chauvinists. Lenin warned about them, you know, it's something that had to be defeated at the time of the Bolshevik revolution. And Putin, you know, blames Lenin for Ukraine. He said if Lenin had given Ukraine the right to self-determination, the right to secession if they wanted it, there would be no Ukraine, which is, you know, an historical revisionism, which is false, because you can go back to Voltaire, and he wrote about how Ukraine is oppressed by outsiders. You know, their national identity and certainly their language and culture existed back then. And as the 1800s and nationalism swept the world, the Ukrainians had their, they were part of that as well. John Wood, we need to press for a peace treaty. It'd be criminal to keep this war going. I guess you're talking about the Ukraine war. And Zelensky has a peace treaty, 10 points. But Russia doesn't want to debate it because the sticking point is Ukraine wants Russia out of its land. And Russia says the oblasts or provinces or states that they have claimed to have annexed are not up for negotiation. Even though their militaries don't control all of those four oblasts, in addition to Crimea, which they do totally control. So, you know, I think, like I was saying before, the way to get Russia to think about pulling out is to come up with, you know, a trans-European security agreement that, you know, Russia can feel good about as well as the Western countries. And then, you know, that rationale for Putin's invasion, that it was self-defense, which is kind of crazy, but that's their rationale. It would disappear, and he could say, okay, we got the security arrangements we wanted and pull out. I think that's the best shot I can see. Otherwise, it's going to be a long war of attrition. Scott Trooper 164, how exactly can we get Putin to agree with the U.S. when there's propagandists in Russia who says they should be in a forever war with the West? Well, you have to make it less costly for Putin to pull out than to stay in the war. And that's where, you know, Ukrainian resistance plays a part. International opprobrium and sanctions plays a part. And then giving Putin a way out by saying he got the security agreements he needed. Now, yeah, there's a, you know, ultra-nationalist power in Russian elites that definitely, you know, they're all about restoring the old Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire. I mean, they're monarchists like Strelkin or Igor Girkin, who's now in prison because he said Putin was a mediocrity. But when he was calling for, you know, being more aggressive against Ukraine and the West, it was fine with Putin. It's just when he got personally insulted. This guy Girkin got arrested for discrediting the armed forces or something. But Girkin represents the whole right wing of the Russian power structure. And they're really carrying on the political traditions of Tsarism. You know, they think, you know, Russia is a special country. It's a civilization on its own, and it deserves to control its own sphere of influence, the Russian Empire. And that's what makes them great. It's kind of a, and in some ways it's a mirror image of Trump, you know, make Russia great again, make America great again. But it's an anti-democratic authoritarian type of politics. But on the other hand, in Russia, there's strong support for a liberal democratic government. I mean, I think the people represented by those now in prison, like Navalny, he's the most prominent. There's a lot of support for that. And that's more of a liberal opposition to Putin. There is a socialist left, but it's very small. The problem in the East Bloc, the former Soviet countries, is that socialism is a bad word because it's equated with repression and not, you know, what socialism traditionally or originally was supposed to be about, full political and economic democracy. You know, the socialists were the most consistent and the fullest Democrats, small d, among political trends in the 19th century. And unfortunately, because the Soviet Union is the reason why that kind of got confused, because a lot of people that called themselves socialists were defending Stalinist repression. And so the socialist movement is suffering for that, I think, ever since. Okay, well, we talked a lot about Ukraine. It's interesting. It's kind of receded from the headlines. And, while everybody's focused on what's going on in Gaza. And in our own headline, that Jill Stein has stepped up to run for president. But that's okay. I think, you know, the Ukraine situation is going to be with us for a while. So we need to keep talking about it. So I will be here next week. I might have a guest. I have a number of people I've been thinking about, and I hesitated to bring them on while things exploded in the Middle East. But maybe by next week I'll have one of them on. So I don't have anybody lined up yet, but I'm going to call some people and see if they're ready to come on. And meanwhile, I hope you'll dig in your pocket and give a little money to Jill Stein and remain active on the ceasefire and ending military aid to Israel, and keep pushing on the climate issue, because we can't let that disappear while these other crises have our attention. So that's it for this week. I'll see y'all next week.